Everyone says that they are searching for truth. Some search in earnest, others are simply saying that because it sounds good to say you're searching for truth. Blaise Pascal once wrote this: "We desire truth, but we find within ourselves nothing but uncertainty. We seek happiness, but we find mainly misery. We are incapable of suppressing the desire for truth and happiness, and yet are incapable of knowing truth and happiness. These frustrated desires remind us how far we have fallen from our true state." We're going to talk about searching for truth during this first half hour of Issues, Etc. Joe Boot, director of Ravi Zacharias International Ministries in Canada, will join us. He's authored a new book titled Searching for Truth, Discovering the Meaning and Purpose of Life. When everyone out there is telling you they can find the purpose of your life for you, or that they can help you find it, what is the purpose of life? What is the truth that we all are seeking but are incapable of finding under our own fallen constraints? Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. A little later in the program, Pastor Ralph Preuss joins us. Why go to church? There are pamphlets and books written in answer to this question, encouraging people to go to church for any and every reason. Ralph Preuss says most of the time they leave out the most important reason. We'll find out what that is when we talk with him. Then also later on, Issues, Etc., a multi-hymn study. This is a pretty brave undertaking. We're going to talk about several hymns in succession with Kathleen Peppercorn and Pastor John Berg later on Issues, Etc. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Those are our phone numbers. Joe Boot is author of this book, Searching for Truth. Joe, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, Todd.
Let's begin with one of those basic questions that philosophy students and classes often take up, and that is the existence of God. You write that the existence of God cannot be demonstrated so as to convince everybody. What do you mean?
Yeah, that's a good question, Todd. I think what I'm trying to express really at the outset of the book is to be completely honest about where human rationality, human reason can take us in regard to this whole question. Answering metaphysical questions, doing philosophy, is not an exact science. And for those who do know anything about philosophy at all, we really understand that the only things that are really provable are those which we can deduce with deductive certainty, and that limits us basically to mathematics. And even those are given, the basic principles of math seem to be given to us by our intuition and not by reason. So when I say that and when I begin with that, what I want to make clear is that the arguments for God's existence that we have classically in terms of classical apologetics were originally written even by the likes of Thomas Aquinas to reinforce the Christian faith to us, for those who actually already have a belief, not to compel the skeptic to believe. They show that the belief in God is reasonable, it's plausible, it's rational, but at a certain point in every single argument you can present for the existence of God, they can be doubted. That doesn't mean to say it's perfectly reasonable to doubt God's existence, but at a certain point, the hardened skeptic can doubt a given point in the argument, in those classical arguments for God's existence. Obviously, if it could be proved beyond a shadow of a doubt, as in a laboratory, that God was there and real, then the question of faith and the other requirements of the knowledge of God would be irrelevant. It would just be a matter of being bright enough, being clever enough, being able to follow the philosopher's arguments.
You also say that the right use of reason usually leads sooner or later to the understanding that reason itself has severe limits upon it.
Yeah, and I think, in fact, you picked it up really with that quotation from Pascal. Pascal was really a brilliant mathematician and a philosopher who really, in a very penetrating way, realized this and highlighted this to the skeptics that he was trying to reach. And as you look through the annals of history and you see some of the greatest thinkers, many of them have come to this place where they said, let's be honest, the great American thinker Jonathan Edwards or even the scientist Albert Einstein, who pointed out very clearly that reason itself, when we really think about things rationally and reasonably, we have to come to the point where we recognize that we are very limited. There are an infinite number of things which are beyond the reach of our reason. Perhaps most astonishingly of all, the very basis of our reasoning powers, the things that we assume to be true that form the foundation of our reasoning, are known by intuition. They're just things that we know. We don't know how we know them. We can't prove them, but we just know them to be true.
I was speaking recently with another Christian apologist, and he has an interesting way of describing the naturalist's explanation for the origin of things. He talks about the story of particles and how the particles get together, and when they get together, they come together and they form life and things like that. He has an interesting way of retelling what many people believe to be, well, axiomatic. You do the same thing. You talk about the tale of the unexpected.
Yeah.
When nothing that was something suddenly went boom. Walk us through that.
Yeah, I think what I do, moving on then there into the sort of third and fourth chapters of the book, having tried to deal with this question of God's existence, is to look at the plausibility structure, look at how realistic it is in ordinary English, to take a non-theistic view of the world, that taking the hypothesis that God is not real and therefore not relevant, we're left with this evolutionary idea of the universe where something comes from nothing. And what I'm really trying to do, even at the beginning with in a poetic way, is to show how, first of all, how counterintuitive that very idea is, that something comes from nothing. It was the ancient Greeks who said, from nothing comes nothing. If the universe brought itself into existence, it must have existed before it existed, which is self-contradictory. So in a kind of playful way there at the beginning, I'm trying to show how counterintuitive and how unreasonable it really is to suggest that the universe sprang into being from nowhere, out of nothing, without cause, without design, without mind, and without purpose. And that is perhaps is one of the greatest stumbling blocks for naturalism. I mean, scientists turn to all kinds of strange ideas now for both the origin of life and the origin of the universe itself. I mean, is the universe some kind of quantum computer? And many turning back to sort of ideas of Mother Earth and the universe itself being a cosmic personality, a cosmic force of some kind, and replacing the idea of God with making God into the universe itself.
Joe Boot is our guest. We're talking about Searching for Truth. He's director of Ravi Zacharias International Ministries in Canada and author of the new book, Searching for Truth, Discovering the Meaning and Purpose of Life. If you'd like to join our conversation, about another 10 minutes left with Joe, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. That's 505-7850. Or 1-800-730-2727. So, it's unreasonable, on the face of it, that something should come from nothing. Most of us understand this. I guess what is important next is to determine, if someone were to believe that, as unreasonable as it is, what conclusions would they then begin to draw, having decided that something came from nothing, namely that we ultimately came from nothing, that there is no source beyond the nothing that there was in the beginning? Where does that lead? Can it lead any place but nowhere? Nothing leads nowhere, right? We're talking about searching for the truth. You know, really, this is the first problem of those who believe in evolution. We talk about the missing link and searching for a link between species. Joe, you point that out in your book. The first problem for the evolutionist is the problem of origins. Explain that.
Yeah. I think one of the things that people immediately get sort of hung up on this question of evolution is as soon as they start to think about that very question, they start thinking about monkeys and talk about the missing link. And actually what they're doing is making the mistake of not starting anywhere near far enough back. And we have to go right back to this whole question. Forget fish becoming reptiles and then mammals and so on and so forth to man. What about the origin first of the universe and then the origin of the first life, of life itself? That is a massive problem. Scientists themselves admit there is no known law of physics or law of chemistry that's able to bring information required for life out of nothing. We still have not discovered any, we're nowhere near discovering a mechanism for the origin of life itself.
Where does it lead if someone is willing to accept the irrational proposition that something, namely us, came from nothing? Then where does that lead?
I think that's a very penetrating question, and I think that really leads us right down a chain of thinking that most people never actually think through. If at the end of the day we've come from nothing and we're going nowhere, it has some very, very serious ethical implications. I think it was the English philosopher Stephen Evans who said that believing in God is not like believing in the Loch Ness Monster. The Loch Ness Monster or the Yeti or fairies, they're just one more thing. But God is not just one more thing. Believing in God or not believing in God changes the very character of the universe. And that is a really important point. It's what we might call the context principle. What is the context in which each of us as individuals, as a families, as communities, what is the context in which we live out our lives? And if that ultimate context is actually godless, then we find that for so many different areas in our lives, we are anchorless. We have no referent outside of ourselves. So let's take what philosopher, actually, William Lane Craig often talks about, is the problem of meaning, of value, and of purpose. If there is no God who exists outside of this universe, who is external to it, who brought us into existence, then what ultimate overarching meaning do our lives really have, other than what we can pretend they have, if you like, that we can give them ourselves in this life? What overarching purpose is there to life? And perhaps most importantly, what values are there to life? What moral values can we really say transcend the individual? And this, of course, leads to the huge problem of relativism in terms of ethics, for example. If there's no God, then there's no lawgiver. If there's no lawgiver, then there can't be a moral law. If there's no moral law, then why are we obliged to do certain things and not to do others? Why is there this sense of oughtness? Why shouldn't I just do as I please? And, of course, history is replete with illustrations with people who have rejected the idea of God, and it has led to tragic results. Communism, Marxism, and Nazism being very relevant 20th century examples of an ethical worldview based upon biological evolution.
You retell or recall a brief story from Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment, in which a man who has denounced the existence of God carries out a crime and yet is left struggling, in spite of his atheism, with his guilt. What does this say, then?
Yeah, I think that really goes to the heart of the problem. The fact is, no matter how much we try and rationalize these things away, both the notion of God and the reality of moral obligation that we feel, the simple fact is, as that illustration goes to show really, that we are unable as human beings to shake off this sense of moral obligation, this sense of oughtness, the reality of our consciences, if you like. And I think in my book I talk about this being like an echo of Eden. Again, poignantly, you read that quotation from Pascal about this sense that we carry in ourselves. We look long for truth and happiness and meaning, and yet we find ourselves unable to fully grasp it, to fully understand it with our unaided reason. And I think this whole question of morality, the conscience, the moral obligation, the sense of oughtness that we all feel is perhaps the most potent example of this voice of God in the soul, this echo of Eden that we all carry, of a sense of God, a sense of his moral law, and even a sense of eternity that's been placed into our hearts and we find unshakable. And what that really does is it puts the person who denies the reality and relevance of God in a very difficult position. It puts us in the position of having a totally incoherent worldview. If we reject God, then actually there are no moral absolutes. There is no objective moral framework. So why do we have this gnawing sense of oughtness, this sense of conscience, this justice that we demand, this sense of right and wrong that is completely universal and unshakable? And that, of course, presents a coherence problem for the naturalist or the atheist worldview.
Lots of people believe in God or a God, but those other gods and their religions are inherently, at their foundations, subjective. Is Christianity any different?
That's a really, really good question. I think that the question of the exclusivity of truth really goes to the heart of the question about competing worldviews. Whenever we a claim is made to truth, in fact, whenever we say we're making a meaningful statement, of necessity, we are there is a sense in which what we're trying to communicate, what we're trying to get across, has a definite meaning. And when the Christian message communicates itself, it is purporting to have a definite meaning, and it is also purporting that that meaning that it gives to its doctrines is actually true. And of course, Jesus himself said, "I am the way, I am the truth, I am the life."
And that truth is based in real events?
Yeah. And, well, I would go further than that and say that Jesus was saying that the truth isn't just an abstract idea, and much of what we've even been discussing so far in our conversation has dealt with some of these abstract issues. What Jesus was actually saying here was that I am reality, I am the ground of being, I am the embodiment of truth, I am the embodiment of life. And so, in a sense, it's going beyond saying that the truth is contained merely in certain propositional statements, but actually that the truth is found, this objective, exclusive truth, is found in a person. This God, who we can often talk about merely in the metaphysical sense, which seems so far beyond us, like the God of Aristotle, for example, is all of a sudden in the Christian message, God puts skin on, if I can put it that way, and not meaning to be irreverent. He comes as a person, as a human being. Of course, he is a person, but he comes in human flesh. And Christ himself says, "I am the truth." In fact, in that famous conversation interview with Pontius Pilate, he says, "Everyone on the side of truth hears my voice," and Pontius Pilate asks the question, "What is truth?" And unfortunately, he didn't wait for the answer. So there is this sense in which, of course, all Christian experience has its subjective side. All knowledge, to a certain degree, has that subjective element. We are the subjects, and we are knowing an object. And so there is that subjective sense in which we relate to one another and relate to given truth claims. But that does not mean that there is not an objective reality out there that we can know. And, of course, that is the contention of the Christian message, that we can know objectively, historically, that Jesus was a real person, that he lived, that he rose from the grave, that there's good evidence for all of this, and that we can come into a personal relationship with objective truth. Subjectively, we ourselves as individuals can come into a relationship with him who is the ultimate objective reality, that is Christ himself. That really is the essence of the Christian message.
So Holy Scripture, far from being merely a book of high-flown philosophy or a superior morality demonstrated through narratives and things like that, far more than that, it is in fact a book, or as Luther put it, the cradle which holds Christ himself.
Yes. Yeah, and I think that it's so important, particularly in this whole area of apologetics, that we recognize that, and that as Christians we recognize that what we're doing is we're not trying to simply impart information or build an argument or show the plausibility of theism. In a sense, those are just things that, to use a baseball term, we're trying to get is to just get somebody to first base. In the end, what we're trying to do is get people all the way around to faith, and that is that Scripture introduces us to a person. It's a relationship. And I love really the approach, again, that Pascal, you've already quoted on the program, really tried to highlight, and that was this idea that really the function of all arguments and all apologetics is to move people into a different epistemic position. And that simply means this, that we have to encourage people to get themselves into a position where the knowledge of God, where a relationship with a person can arise. I've got an 18-month-old daughter, so I'm a new father. And when I come home from work and I want to see my daughter, I don't just want to infer her presence in the house from the toys that are all over the floor. I want to get into the room where she is so that we can know one another relationally. And God is personal, and Christ is a person who we are trying to introduce people to. And, of course, that is the essence of this wonderful message, that we are to be introduced to this person called Christ. We don't just want to infer him in the abstract, in the theoretical sense. We want to know him. And really the purpose of Searching for Truth as a book, which I believe is the function of apologetics, is to move people's epistemic position. That's the idea of knowledge. How can a knowledge of God arrive? Well, it can only arrive, according to the Bible, when we take the attitude, actually, of a child, where we take a humble attitude before God. In fact, Hebrews says that anyone who comes to God must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who sincerely seek him. If we can just bring people into a position where they're seeking God, where they believe, first of all, that it's possible that there is a God, that he may be real and relevant to my life, and that I'm willing to seek him and humble myself and look for him and seek him out, well, the Bible really teaches that that's a challenge that God accepts. Those who seek will find. Those who knock, the door will be opened. If people can come into that position of seeking, that relational knowledge of God can arise, so that we do more than infer God's presence and God's reality. We can come to know him in our own individual experience.
Joe Boot is our guest. Joe, would you stay with us for a few minutes?
I will do.
All right. Joe will be right back after this break. We're talking about searching for truth. We need to draw a bright line here between what Joe has been talking about, the apologetic task, and properly speaking, the evangelistic task. They sometimes meld into one another. Apologetics deals with these issues of skepticism. Someone who says, I don't care that there is a God. Well, apologetics will say, you know, there are reasons why you should care. Someone says, I can't know that. Apologetics says, yes, you can know it. In fact, you can't not know it. Evangelism is God's task, by which, through the revelation of his Son Jesus Christ as the Savior, not just a man of history, but the one who came into history in human flesh and gave his life for us, with all those promises attached to the things he did in history for us, the forgiveness of sins, life and salvation. When God brings about this proclamation, God creates faith. Apologetics can render the skeptic and disarm the skeptic, render the skeptic speechless and without any recourse, but only God can create faith through the proclamation of Jesus Christ and him crucified. When we come back from this break, we'll continue for a few minutes talking with Joe Boot, director of Ravi Zacharias International Ministries in Canada. He's author of a new book called Searching for Truth, Discovering the Meaning and Purpose of Life. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. When we come back, what role does the resurrection of Jesus Christ play? Is it merely just the greatest thing he ever did? Kind of his ultimate miracle, going out with a bang, so to speak? Or is it far more significant than that when we talk about the actual events around which our faith is built? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Faith alone, that was Martin Luther's cry, wasn't it? Yes, but is that all Luther had to say? Was there more to the Reformation than this? And why was it necessary for Luther to assert that we are saved by grace through faith for the sake of Christ alone? Our new Issues, Etc. book of the month for October is called Lift High This Cross, The Theology of Martin Luther. You can order Lift High This Cross online. Go to our website, issuesetc.org, click on the What's New section, and you'll find information about the book. Or call Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. When you call or write, mention Issues Etc. It's the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for October, Lift High This Cross, The Theology of Martin Luther.
Now this Global Minute focuses prayer on cities in Euro-Asia needing Christ's love. It's an area rich in culture, different language groups, and people needing Christ. Stretching across Russia and Ukraine from Europe into Asia is a mix of people living in major urban centers. Atheists, Muslims, Christians, and even Buddhist and spirit worshipers are found in the various urban places. The mission agency Evangelical Bible Mission is building up local Christians to start new churches and grow their ministries. EBM reports ministry growth taking place, but more prayer partners are needed to break through some of the spiritual barriers. Non-Russian city dwellers may be suspicious of Russian Christians, while Christians from different denominations may be suspicious of each other. Pray for Christ to be glorified in the Euro-Asian region. EBM invites you to pray and get involved in missions. Call 1-800-804-9524 or log on to evminternational.com.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. One network advertises Thursday night as must-see TV. What is it that we must see? Friends? A show about sex and self-obsession? Will and Grace? Same themes. Coupling? That title itself is offensive. Other possibilities for tonight: Temptation Island, Queer Eye for the Straight Guy, and Sex, Secrets, and Betrayals, to name a few. Unfortunately, there's a market for that stuff. Kind of like the raccoon that comes out at night and loves to get into the garbage can. The ultimate problem isn't the programming, but the viewers who tolerate it. Jesus says in Mark 7, nothing that goes into a person from outside can make him unclean. It's what comes out of a person that makes him unclean. Evil thoughts, sexual sins, stealing, murder, adultery, greed, wickedness, cheating, shameless lust, envy, cursing, arrogance, and foolishness come from within a person. All these evils come from within and make a person unclean. Tonight, Diane and Dale will argue about what we are going to watch. I'll want to watch sports or news or the History Channel. Diane will want to watch HGTV. Guess who will win? At least the lid is on our garbage can.
So you've taken a trip down the aisle and you're now Mr. and Mrs. Life couldn't be better, or your new spouse more perfect.
Love you, hon.
But you know, marriage is a long haul, and divorce seems to be everywhere. You want to keep the warm glow you feel now. It's time you discovered Focus on the Family with Dr. James Dobson. A half hour of sound advice for today's families. Focus on the Family.
Weekdays at 9:30 on AM 850 KFUO.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. A few minutes here concluding our conversation with Joe Boot, director of Ravi Zacharias International Ministries in Canada, talking about searching for truth, author of the new book, Searching for Truth, Discovering the Meaning and Purpose of Life. If you'd like to join us, our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Joe, by way of summary of our conversation here, it sounds as though the Achilles heel of reason, and in particular scientific knowledge, is that instead of admitting its limits, it rather declares everything outside those limits to simply be non-existent, like moral absolutes, or even God himself. Pointing out the proper flaw?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think really the... one of the things I discuss in the chapter, the Science of Belief, is really to pick up on that very thought. That actually, for most people, they haven't really understood the philosophy of science and what the very concept of science actually deals with. First of all, the very fact that it was because of the Christian worldview, because of the theistic worldview, a view of once Christianity had taken root in the sort of 14, 15, 1600s and the birth of modern science, what we found was that people now believing in a personal, knowable God, that his works could also be known and understood, and they would have a purpose and an order to them, and so modern science was born. And the limitations of science, as you say, are so crucial. It's so crucial that we understand them, so we recognize the limits of where science can comment. Science is dealing with empirical data. It's looking at certain observational facts and seeking to reach from those observations wider conclusions. And by definition, there is nothing absolute about science. It works on a sliding scale of probability. Low probability is a hypothesis, moderate high probability is theory, high probability is law. But even those things which we call laws are not proven as such. And so it is absolutely crucial that when we are in discussion with people who are wrestling with this issue, that we do point up the limitations, the very real limitations of science.
Finally, can science, with these unrecognized limits, it simply refuses to recognize its own, can it say anything to us regarding ethics, right and wrong? And if it were to say anything, would it be coherent?
I really don't think that it can give us these things at all. I think it's totally outside the realm of empirical observation to deal with man's moral nature. Now, of course, there have been certain attempts to do that. There have been this idea of Dawkins' idea, the Oxford-based zoologist, that we're just merely dancing to our DNA. Maybe our genes determine our behavior, and that's how science could maybe even alter moral behavior. But these things are all very much grasping at straws. Really, when we actually look at the naturalistic framework of science, which most, unfortunately, sadly, most science is conducted through this, looking through the spectacles of naturalism. If you like, you've got two sets of spectacles out there. All data that comes to us has to be interpreted. There's no such thing as an already interpreted piece of information. We're all looking at the same evidence. How do we interpret that evidence? It has to be interpreted according to a framework. And that's, of course, the distinction between those who look at intelligent design or creation and those who take an evolutionary view. We're looking at the same data, but we're interpreting it differently. Now, when it comes to this whole question of ethics, with the naturalistic spectacles on, one can only end up by asking the question, how can a biological is produce a moral ought? Just because we know what is biologically, or we've theorized or hypothesized evolution biologically, how can that bring us to an ethical imperative or ethical imperatives? And the response of some in the 20th century, like Julian Huxley and others, was that we had to do it purely on the basis of evolution. And some of the framers of the Humanist Manifesto also went along with this essential idea that we are the custodians of evolution, and therefore whatever favors the fit, the healthy survival of the fittest is the only principle on which we can build an ethic. Therefore, eliminate the weak and the unfit. And of course, we saw the tragic illustration of that in action as to use a very harsh example, Hitler's program in Nazi Germany. But we've got more modern examples. We've got the likes of Dawkins in Oxford, who says that there is no such thing as right and wrong, just blind, pitiless indifference. We've got the likes of Peter Singer in the States there, who, because of his naturalistic and evolutionary understanding of the world, doesn't see the difference in value of a human infant or that of a pig. So in the end, I don't think they do produce any degree of coherence. You either end up with absolute moral terror, as seen within some of the communist and Nazi practices that built their moralities around evolution, or you end up with this totally counterintuitive, incoherent views of morality that are purely subjective, purely based on whatever we feel like doing. In fact, it was Darwin himself who said that if there is no moral law, if there's no external moral law, nothing that God is legislating for us, then he said, I can only see that we must do those things for which to us seem to be the best ones, those impulses, those instincts which to us seem strongest. Now, of course, for some, that's rape, that's murder. So we end up with a totally incoherent, totally counterintuitive, and totally unworkable moral framework. And I would say that that is true across the board.
Joe Boot, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues, Etc.
Thank you, Todd. It's been my privilege.
Joe Boot is director of Ravi Zacharias International Ministries in Canada and author of the new book, Searching for Truth, Discovering the Meaning and Purpose of Life. Let this conversation serve as a stern warning. Simply listen to what we are hearing today. Big biotech. On the basis of a view of man that says man really came from nothing, and therefore, since nothing can come from nothing, although he appears to be something, he really remains, in essence, nothing and worth nothing. Big biotech says, well, we can't ground our morality in that. They're smart enough to know that. So they simply live by this ethic. What we can do, we should do. So if we can take human embryos and rob them of their stem cells, killing them in the process, and experiment for cures for diseases with those stem cells, since we can, we should. It appears as though they're never asking whether or not what they're doing is right and wrong. But they are. They're simply using an entirely different ethic to get their answer. If we are merely the product of random chance and matter, then what we can do, we should do. In fact, how are we to know that all these things that we can do aren't simply just more instances of mass and matter and random chance coming together? How are we to know that we might not be, by what we do, furthering our own evolution? It's not that there is no ethic. It's the only ethic they have left. When you draw God out of the picture, and when, rather than acknowledging the limits of your knowledge, you simply declare everything outside those limits to be non-existent. God, morality, the value of a human life. It can't be weighed on a scale, can it? You can't put a human being on a scale and measure his or her value. Therefore, we have a completely different ethic. What we can do, we should do. Occasionally, we have this ethic set back, but I don't know how it happens. The news from Washington today, we talked about this a bit yesterday. The U.S. House has overwhelmingly approved a ban on partial birth abortion, but in the Senate, Democratic senators are delaying their approval. Since everyone leaves for recess today, we've got 10 days until the Senate returns to take up this issue again. You know what partial birth abortion is, don't you? It is exactly what the term describes. A child partly born, then killed. It is infanticide, as is all abortion. But it is a degree of infanticide that even those who support other kinds of abortion find hard to deny. They'll even call it infanticide or near infanticide. Do we think that if we have a ban on this and a law that will keep people from doing this, that we've changed anyone? We might have changed a few minds. We haven't changed any hearts. We had a caller yesterday who rightly pointed out that in one sense, you can't legislate morality. You can legislate behavior, but if you're talking about morality, that is the desire to do good or do evil, that can't be legislated. It's not that people who think partial birth abortion is right have no ethics. They have an ethic. It's the only ethic they're left with. When you believe that we came from nowhere, out of nothing, The ethic is what we can do, we should do. We can partially deliver a baby all the way out to the third trimester and kill that baby. And if we can, we should. Because in a universe without a God, what's stopping us? And it's not only that there won't be any consequences for it under this ethic, it is that it's not even something that would require consequences. Think about it this way. Someone who says there is no right or wrong still has stated their own particular ethics. They've said all bets are off. Now what I should do is determined entirely by what I can do. Now you and I look at this and we say, people don't live this way. If you really live by what you can do, you should do, there's nothing to stop me, and there's no reason I shouldn't take someone else's property. Just walk off with it. Declare it to be my own. There's no reason why I shouldn't. Because I can do it. See, if I have access to his property and he leaves it alone, if what I can do determines what I should do, and if I take that person's property, especially if he happens to be someone who says there is no right and wrong, he's going to get upset. But I could gently remind him, you know, there's really no reason for you to get upset. The sad thing is he might agree with me. He might say, you're right. There's no reason I should be upset. There's also no reason I shouldn't kill you for taking my property. And I'd have to agree with him. Yep, according to your ethic, that's true. How few steps it takes living under that ethic to get to the ultimate crime against our neighbor, taking his life. The next 15 minutes are open lines for your questions and your comments. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. I mentioned here that the House has passed this, well, it's now called the conference bill, came out of the conference committee, back to the House and the Senate for their approval, then onto the president's desk. The House has overwhelmingly approved this in a vote of 281-142. The Senate, on the other hand, has decided that they will wait another 10 days. They've got a recess. But according to Douglas Johnson, we talked to him recently, that's not going to present much of a problem. The president does say that he will sign this. I guess it could present a problem. Barbara Boxer is reportedly insisting on extensive further debate before allowing a final vote in the Senate. But again, those who count the votes say the votes are simply there. 53 senators in favor of the ban on partial birth abortion, so they can debate all they want. We've been talking about this Luther movie, and there have been glowing reviews, there have been mixed reviews. I read one from the Catholic Register the other day that was largely negative. Another one comes across my desk. This one from the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops. From their website, under the heading Film and Broadcasting, their review of the Luther movie. A synopsis. Sweeping but flawed historical drama about the life of Martin Luther, the 16th century German monk instrumental in triggering the Protestant Reformation. Though making the issues and the personalities accessible to modern viewers, Eric Till's biopic veers from historical accuracy, oversimplifying complex religious and political issues, glossing over Luther's shortcomings with a revisionist glaze, while painting the church as worldly and self-indulgent, recurring violence and theological complexities. That's their summary. Here's the full review. The life of Martin Luther, the 16th century monk who forever changed the face of Christianity, is explored in the sweeping but flawed historical drama Luther. While bringing the period and its key personalities vividly to life, director Eric Till's well-crafted biopic, that it's another word for biopic, of course, veers steadily from a balanced historical accuracy toward hagiography. Now, do you guys know what hagiography is? Hagia means holy. And, of course, graphe, to write, a writing about a holy person. And usually this term is used in a derogatory way to say you've taken someone of historical significance and you've written about them and you've glossed over all their flaws. We do this with our own figures of American history all the time. Yeah, we talk about George Washington having wooden teeth and things like that, but we do not want to delve into serious character flaws if they exist. We often engage with our favorite figures of history in hagiography. I told you before this was my biggest worry about the Luther film, that it would do just this, that it would be hagiography, it would be a glossing over of the real man to paint him in too rosy a light. Although I find it ironic that the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, in their review of this film, accuse it of being a hagiography when, well, I think even the Catholic bishops would admit that they invented hagiography. At least the Roman Catholic Church did. Literally. They invented it. A little bit of the pot calling the kettle black. The review goes on. Throughout the narrative, Till, the director, deflects blame away from Luther, glossing over his shortcomings with a gilded revisionist glaze. The film literally opens in the midst of a raging electrical storm, metaphorically setting the stage for the theological maelstrom that would eventually sweep across Europe. Caught in the tempest is a young German law student, Martin Luther. Fearing for his life, he promises to forsake his legal career for a monk's cowl in exchange for God's protection against the elements. It summarizes a film a little bit farther. And then it says this. Time and the desire for narrative clarity prohibit the filmmaker from lingering too long on any subsequent theological sparring matches after, of course, the significant ones in the film, between Firebrand Luther and his ecclesiastical adversaries, resulting in an oversimplification of the complex religious and political issues involved. While many of the abuses documented are tragically based on verifiable truth, the film presents several arguments which contain skewed, if not outright false, interpretations of Catholic doctrine. Now, I would ask this at this particular point. Is that the film's fault? It may be. It may be. Is that the film's fault, or is it that Roman Catholics of the time were falsely interpreting their own teachings? For instance, in the film, if you will remember, folks, the issue of indulgences. We're told all the time, indulgences were never intended to be some sort of teaching that you could get forgiveness from God just by putting money in the coffer. They were simply a release from temporal punishment, from a state of purgatory, not hell, but a state of purgatory, which God's justice demanded. Now, I think the film accurately depicted that. But think about the error that lies behind purgatory. We're all worried about purgatory whenever we talk about Roman Catholic doctrine. Think about the error that lies behind it. Purgatory itself is not the problem. It's a false teaching, there's no doubt about it, but it is only a symptom of a greater false teaching. You know what that is? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. There is a teaching, an undisputed teaching, in the Roman Catholic Church that leads logically to the assertion of purgatory. And indulgences are more or less icing on the cake. I mean, you don't have to have indulgences if you teach purgatory. You could say there's a purgatory, a place, a state, that is, after this life, before entering into eternal life, where the soul is purged of any excess impurities, moral impurities. and where temporal consequences, which you just can't live long enough to suffer all the temporal consequences for the sins you do, they're meted out to the soul. And then, after all the temporal consequences have been paid at purgatory, you may enter eternal life. Because God is just, and temporal consequences cannot be mitigated. Except, now you could teach that and say, and there are no exceptions. No exceptions whatsoever. Whatever temporal consequences you pile up for your sins in this life, you'll have to pay the full price for them, or at least have them all exacted from you in a state of purgatory before entering eternal life. Now, one might say it was rather magnanimous of the church in the Middle Ages to say, except if the church grants you an indulgence, that is, time off for good behavior here in this life. Yes, the Pope did that just in the year 2000. It's undeniable. He issued a papal decree during that year of Jubilee granting indulgence for good behavior, helping the poor, giving money to the church, doing acts of kindness. One might say it's magnanimous. If the church has the power to free people from the temporal consequences of their sins here in this life and then the consequences exacted in purgatory, well, they're being magnanimous to allow that for mere money or good behavior. There's a point in the film where Luther says, if the Pope can forgive, now I think he says, and this is probably overblown, forgive sins. Forgive the consequences of sins in purgatory. If he can do that, why doesn't he do it out of love and not for money? It's a good question. It's a very good question. It gets right to the very heart of the error, the real error, in the teaching of purgatory. Our phone numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. The Catholic bishops go on to say this: the film also produces or promotes an erroneous understanding of indulgences. While it is certain that abuses involving their dispensation did occur, St. Peter's Basilica is evidence that they did occur on a grand scale. The film mistakes those abuses for official church teaching. You know what? Luther never vied against the official church teaching on indulgences. He was convinced that what he was vying against was an abuse. He was convinced that what he was fighting against was an abuse. The real error behind purgatory, the teaching that God's justice is not entirely and completely satisfied at the cross. You see, if there's anything, even temporal consequences, left to be paid by the sinner after Christ is done dying for him, then you have less a Christ crucified for sinners than Scripture gives us. God's justice is completely satisfied, utterly satisfied, by the obedience and death of His Son. We'll be right back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.